Call me Ishmael. You don't have to be a Melville scholar to know that's the opening line of Moby Dick. It's that way with a lot of famously great classics, but most of the books you can quote are ones you've read, not just once, but again and again. You could call them your own personal classics. What are the books you reach for when you need some wisdom or comfort, maybe a deeper connection with your own sense of what's timeless and true? One of the books I'm always pulling from my own shelf is Invisible Cities by Italo Calvino. It begins this way. Kublai Khan does not necessarily believe everything Marco Polo says. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, the bibliophiles are going to tell us about their personal classics, and we want to hear about yours, too. Join the conversation at 816-235-2888. Let's meet the bibliophiles. Katie Stover, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
Katie's here with us from the Kansas City Public Library. Mark Luce from the Barstow School, hello to you, too.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Doing just great. Thank you.
Jeffrey Ann Gowdy is a freelance writer and book critic. You can read her stuff in the Kansas City Star and the Huffington Post. Thanks for being here, Jeff.
Good to be here.
And we have a fourth panelist this morning. Natasha Rhea Elskari is a poet. Hi, Natasha.
Good morning.
So I want you each to start with the first book you knew you wanted to bring in for today's topic. Natasha, could you kick this off for us?
Yes, sure. The first book, which is kind of like the first and the first, but the first is Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. I selected this book because when I picked it up to read it and I found that there was dialect inside of it, I fell in love.
When was that? How old were you?
I was about 16 years old when I was first introduced to the book. And I was introduced to the book through a librarian that just fed me. I had a great appetite. That's where I would sometimes skip classes. And as long as I was quiet and reading, I just kind of got to do that. And so she slid this one along with others to me. And it was just really life-changing. And I did a lot of graduate school work with Zora Neale Hurston. And so, I mean, with her work. And so it just stuck with me.
Is there a scene in this book that you recall really vividly, sort of as you're just going about your day-to-day life sometimes?
Yeah, it's the pear tree where Janie, it's all about feminine power and internal feminine
energy. She's sitting like in or under the pear tree?
Under the pear tree. And what happens after that, you know, kind of starts a downward spiral. But in that moment, it is just the most magical moment. And as a girl, I shared moments like that with nature, even as an urban dweller. And so it just hit home with me, everything that she was experiencing internally, and then her actions after that. And so I feel like that particular scene is the scene that completely embodies the height of female sexual empowerment and discovery, self-discovery.
It has been a long time since I've read that book, but there are a couple of scenes that I remember really vividly from it. And as an overall kind of idea, what I remember from it is the idea about how people try to have strong relationships when they're all dealing with something really oppressive, sort of. They've all got this shared problem and how that affects their ability to have really good relationships with each other and sort of from one generation to the next.
Yeah, and I think the choice for women, the limited choice, at least when Zora Neale Hurston wrote this book, what the options were for women and for girls, particularly if you were attractive or uneducated or in an area that didn't have a lot of opportunities. And so, and the powerful storytelling to women in conversation with each other, which I think is also why I really love the book, because the book is all about, it is written from her telling a friend the story of her life amidst all these rumors that were completely untrue about who she was, which I think is often the case for women who choose to navigate their lives outside of the status quo.
There's a line that I remember that's an older woman, I don't remember the character's name, saying to Janie, the main character, "Set me down easy, Janie, I'm a cracked plate."
Yes.
I love that.
Right. And there are so many, because Zora Neale Hurston was an anthropologist and collected all of these stories and sayings and things like that. She would just say certain things that, I don't know, that
bring truth.
Bring truth. Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of picked a little section, but just
if it's pretty quick, you can read it.
Well, you know, I was like, that's what I was looking at. But no, I don't have it to where I can pull that.
Well, our listeners will just have to pick up a copy.
Yes.
But I should say that your copy is well annotated in green pen.
So that's one of the things I love about books, is that I write in my books. I yell. I talk back. I say, go back here. I pull out themes. Definite full interaction. That is why I purchased books and never checked them out from the library. If I loved it, once mm-hmm. I loved it, I went back and purchased it mm-hmm. so that I could write in it. And so when people borrow my books, I get pretty serious about the return. So, yeah.
It's okay with me if you write in my books. Well, so if you're like Dorothy Parker, too, if you get mad at a book, you could throw it across the room.
I think I've done that a few times.
Which yeah. you can't do with an iPad.
You better not.
Natasha Rhea Elskari just recommended Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. Now, Katie Stover, what was the first thing that came to mind that you knew you had to bring?
The first book I thought that I wanted to bring was Evicted by Matt Desmond. And partially, Gina, because no matter what you chose for a theme today, I was going to make it fit. I want to talk about this book a lot. I've been talking about this book since last January when I received this battered galley I brought with me today. This is an important book. I think it's one of the most important books I've read this year. And I've been telling folks, if you only read one book this year, read this book. It just made the New York Times Best Books of 2016. I'm disappointed it didn't win the National Book Award, but that's okay. But there are few narrative nonfiction books that break down social issues and drop them into your own life in as articulately a way as Desmond did with his book. He uses a lot of smart reporting and scholarship to show how housing should be as basic a right as public education. And readers will follow several families in Evicted, and they're all trying to do better, and they can't because the housing situation is bleak and it's designed to upend their lives. The most poignant story I follow is that of Arlene and her two sons. She works as much as she can. She's working two jobs, and after she's paid her rent, she has $20 to feed her family on.
And for a month?
For a month. $20. Is this a situation the fault of the landlords? Well, Desmond follows Sharina. She's a self-made landlord entrepreneur. She was a teacher for a while and then decided she wasn't making enough money doing that. So she went into real estate and she runs, you know, these slum houses. And her situation is marginally better. I mean, she might be the one getting the money, but she's running these horrible houses with conditions that she can't improve on these buildings because she's not getting the money from her tenants to improve their living quarters. So what's interesting about Evicted is there really are no villains here. Readers will respond in rage. This might be a book you throw across the room because you're angry at the situation. But if you only want to read one book this year, please read Evicted by Matthew Desmond.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when I think about today's theme, the personal classic, whether we're talking about the classics or my classics, I guess I tend to think of something timeless. But it's also true that there have been people who have written out of sort of social rage in the past and we do consider those works classics, even though they're responding to a very specific situation in a very specific time and place, like Martin Luther King's Letters from a Birmingham Jail.
Mm-hmm. That's Sinclair Lewis.
Classic.
You can, I do think that Evicted will probably be adopted as a text because it is so readable. It's not daunting. It looks thick. It has a very speedy storyline. Matthew Desmond did that on purpose. So his narrative runs quickly. You will be turning the pages to see how all these people turn out. I can see this book being adopted as a text for high schools, in college sociology classes. It's the kind of book that could become a modern classic after a few years.
Like The Grapes of Wrath is what I'm thinking about.
Oh.
Just something that is about that particular time and space. But we are still reading that. My son read it recently. So, you know, I read it when I was in school because it is very particular to that inescapable condition and specific to that time and space, which I think is important.
On the strength of Katie's recommendation on Facebook, I bought it for my son, who's in college. He was a freshman last year, and it completely, well, I guess it would have been in the spring because it came out in January, and it completely turned his head around. He could not stop talking about it.
You will think about lots of different elements of the working poor, not just the housing situation, but jobs and the social services that are designed to help them, and in some cases don't. And it's heartbreaking. This is a heartbreaking read. It will make you angry. And it was, I think I tweeted that I hope Donald Trump read this book.
He said he doesn't read.
Well, I wasn't really expecting him to tell me yes, but.
So Katie's recommending Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City by Matthew Desmond. And so, Mark Luce, what are you going to tell us about now?
I'm actually going to surprise you all. And the first book that I thought of was actually Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf. And when I was an undergraduate at KU, I took an honors pro seminar that I really had no business being in. It was called Aesthetics of the Fragment, which is a very pretentious sounding name. But Cheryl Lester was the professor, and there were a bunch of female graduate students in the class, and I was just a lowly undergrad. And they were so smart and so intimidating. One of them is still a dear friend, Lori Askelin, who teaches up at outside of Ohio. And we had to read To the Lighthouse. I had no idea. I read it. I had no idea what was going on. I thought it was boring. I thought it was stupid. They talked about it so intelligently that clearly I was, you know, I was mistaken on some level. So I just kind of lashed out at Virginia Woolf in general for basically a decade.
For confusing you.
For not being any good. that was the reasoning. I mean, but
that was
yes.
What you thought at the time.
Right. And so
how old were you again? You're like 18 at this time?
Probably 19 or 20. And then about 10 years later, 9 years later, somewhere in there, I had to read The Hours when I was on the National Book Critics Circle board. And it was a novel about Mrs. Dalloway. And I didn't want to read it. I'm like, this is going to be stupid. You know, Virginia Woolf, stupid. So I read the book, was absolutely blown away by the novel. And so, I mean, by extension, I had to pick up Mrs. Dalloway. And I've now taught Mrs. Dalloway to my AP kids for the last 9 or 10 years.
And why? What is it about this book that
I think there are a couple things. I think one, she's a genius writer. She's absolutely wonderful in the way that she portrays what was like, you know, 1920s London. The way that she portrays this woman who is trapped on one hand by the actions of others and on another hand by the actions of herself. You know, a little while ago, Natasha said someone navigating outside the status quo, and Mrs. Dalloway would love to do that, but she can't. Septimus does. And I think that each time that I read it, the thing that strikes me is there's this one passage that says, the compensation of growing old, Peter Walsh thought, coming out of Regent's Park and holding his hat in his hand, was simply this, that the passions remain as strong as ever, but one has gained, at last, the power which adds a supreme flavor to existence, the power of taking hold of experience, of turning it around slowly in the light. And so for me, being able to look at this, you know, thoroughly uninformed, priggish attitude toward Woolf that I had when I was 19 years old to a very different response to Woolf when I'm of a different age. is, I find, to be absolutely gorgeous. And each time that I read it, I get a little something different out of it. And what I see now is a much more of a scathing social critique of how Britain treated its mentally ill. And so, and again, it's a rich book. It's a wonderful book to teach. And so for me, it's, when I thought personal classic, it's like, it's something that I dismissed out of hand with no real apparent reason, that I grew to absolutely love.
Do you think, with that passage you just read, and this sort of meditation on someone trying to operate outside the status quo but can't, someone who's on some level trapped by outside forces and on some level trapped by herself, I mean, when we think about something that's really a great work of literature that you can go back to again and again and again and get something different out of it, do you think that maybe part of what that means is that a sense of being trapped, that is part of the human condition?
Maybe. I mean, we can be trapped by a lot of different things. We can be trapped by hubris. We can be trapped by faulty memory. We can be trapped by circumstance. But one of the things that I think is that within that entrapment, the human part is trying to sort of recognize it and then perhaps step outside of it. And one of the things that Mrs. Dalloway does, you know, the Bradshaw, the jerk doctor, comes to the party and is like, oh, well, this fellow committed suicide. And she's so mad because it's ruining the party. He brought death to the party. But as she goes upstairs and looks across the window, she sees that she was actually glad that he did it, glad that he threw it away, and that somehow now she can feel sort of that fire of existence rather than the monotony of daily London upper class life. And so to me, that's pretty cool, being able to have that moment where, oh, there is something better, right? And even if it's just a moment, even if it's just fleeting, that's a good thing. And so for me, being able to have that little tiny moment of hope, or being able to take that experience and look at it in a little bit different way, is something, at least for me, has come certainly hard fought with age. It's what?
Pretty dark, though.
Oh, no. I think it would be the exact opposite. I think it would be – it's absolutely lovely that you're able to take something before and kind of look at it a different way and see the sort of mistakes of your past. I mean, to me, that's a good thing.
Mark Luce is recommending Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, a 20-year-old version of himself is shocked. Let's talk now to Jeffrey Ann Gowdy and get her top recommendation for what she would consider to be a personal classic, something that would be required reading for all of humanity were it her choice.
Okay, well, the first book that popped in my mind was A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, because my family reads it every year this time of year. And we first read it in 1988, I think. My daughter was six, and we had a long road trip to Dallas. And in the 8 hours it took to drive there, we read the book. And then a couple of years later, my parents gave me a lavish hardback edition. And so we would take, in the run-up to Christmas Eve, we would read a stave a night, you know, culminating in Christmas Eve, the last stave. And over the years, we've kind of lapsed. And so now we have sort of the greatest hits. So my hardback that I have in front of me is festooned with Post-it notes. And some are yellow and some are pink. And so we have the light Christmas Carol greatest hits and the dark Christmas Carol greatest hits. But I think it's a fabulous story of personal renewal. And Dickens published it in 1843, and he self-published, and he did a very well-appointed edition with red cloth and gilt trim, so he didn't make much money, but it was an instant hit. And we all know this story, but I'll just sort of recap what the high points are for me. Ebenezer Scrooge is, of course, an incredible miser. And I think the thing that I love about this book is just sort of the energy that propels you, the enthusiasm, the ebullience of it. So the famous first sentence, Marley was dead to begin with. So Ebenezer is a Scrooge, and he's walking down the streets. He's accosted by a couple of gentlemen who want him to make a charitable donation. And he asks famously, and in a timeless manner. Are there no prisons? He goes to sleep that night, and it's the 7th anniversary of Marley's death, and he's visited by Marley dragging chains. And Marley foretells that he will be visited by 3 ghosts, the ghost of Christmas past, present, and future. It's all very timeless. We live in the present, trying to get him to live in the present. So he flies around and sees himself as a solitary lad and boarding school. He sees himself as the employee of the very generous Mr. Fezziwig, and he feels terrible at how he's treating Bob Cratchit, and then on and on. He also sees the daughter of his sweetheart who broke up with him because of his growing greedy ways.
So, and Jeff, then, you know, at the risk of we don't. So this story is basically one of a man looking back at his own past and seeing where a life that continues the way he's currently leading it might land him.
Right.
And what is it about either the story itself or the way the story is told that you're not alone in reading it every single December in a sort of communal way? What do you think it is about this story that inspires people to do that?
It's a story of renewal, of redemption, of the possibility of second chances and change, and of being a curmudgeon, being dead inside, and waking up and seeing the world with the eyes of a child.
We are hearing about the books our bibliophiles turn to when they want to tap into what's timeless and universal about the human condition, when they want to transcend their everyday stresses and distractions. What book does that for you? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today, our bibliophiles are here to help us compile a list of great works of literature that connect us with something timeless and beautiful and true. What are the books that can do that for you? Tell us what's on your personal literary canon. Call 816-235-2888. The bibliophiles are Katie Stover, Jeffrey Angowdy, Mark Luce, and Natasha Rhea Elskari. Hi again, guys.
Hi, good morning. Hi,
good morning.
So, Katie, what is the next book you want to tell us about?
Well, since we're also talking a little bit about humanity and maybe how to reconnect, I'm going to talk briefly about How to Be Interesting by Jessica Hagee. I was thinking about our email exchange about literature and humanity, and I remembered this book that I love a lot because I pick up this handy little book when I think I'm not connecting well enough with those in my world. So as far as Jessica Hagee's concerned, there's only 10 steps. And in the effort to be more interesting, you'll be getting out of your comfort zone. You'll be engaging with the world in different, non-threatening, edifying ways. And she suggests that you explore and share, do something, do anything, try new things. My favorite chapter is the one about ask questions. She says that questions make you smarter and get you kicked out of the cult. And she just offers, when I feel like I'm in a funk and I'm not connecting, this is one of my favorite books to turn to remind me how to connect with my world, different things I can be doing if I want to get out of my work rut or I want to get out of my regular zone of always seeing the same things, traveling the same route to work. So I love this book, How to Be Interesting. It's tiny, it's fun, it's pithy. And I just opened up to anything random. Smile at sneers. Not everyone will understand you. Not everyone will appreciate you. Not everyone will embrace you. Do not change for them. Just smile at them and move along. That's pretty sage advice in our turbulent times. If you just move along and let those folks be the way they are. So that one's come on. That one's recently made an entry on my personal keep forever classic list.
Well, so that's another recommendation from Katie Stover for How to Be Interesting
in 10 Simple Steps by Jessica Hagee.
Well, so, you know, I reached out to the staff at KCUR for some recommendations, and a couple of different people on KCUR staff, when we think about the personal classic, the book that for you is a classic, whether it's a classic for the rest of the world or not, one that came up more than once is The World According to Garp by John Irving. Andrea Tudhope, who is producing this show today, has recommended it. And so did Bill Anderson. He's our program director. He says, "It was my realization that it's okay to care about flawed characters and that more often than not, they're a reflection of most everyone's human experience. His love and concern for his children stuck with me. And when I became a parent, I found myself behaving GARP-like in my defense and loyalty to my children." Has anyone here read that book?
And
sure. Mark, tell us more about why it might be that The World According to GARP is something that many people reach for again and again.
Well, for me, I mean, I can tell you, for me, it was that I read it when I was fairly young. So I was probably 17 or 18, and I really didn't know. I mean, I really didn't know what it was. You know, I thought it was a kind of a book about wrestling, and then there was like a little bit of sex in it. And so, you know, I mean, and there's a book within a book. So for me, it was like I always liked the way that I felt when I was reading it, which was just sort of warm. And I was doing something I wasn't supposed to do. And I'm a big fan of that. Like if you're reading and it feels like you're not supposed to be doing it or you're enjoying it a little too much, it's like that's kind of the joy of reading.
Huh. Okay. So The World According to GARP by John Irving is a popular personal classic. Natasha, I'm looking at your pile of well-worn books, and I see the cover of The Color Purple facing me.
Yes, and you see my original copy all yellow, and they don't even write in font like this anymore. I mean, this is probably why I'm half blind, but I love this book because it is epistolary, written as letters, letters to God, then letters to Nettie from the character of Celie. Most people have viewed the movie The Color Purple, which in its own right is absolutely amazing, but the book, like most times, the book is 10 times better than the movie because, of course, you can't include all the details. And so I love this book because I love the rawness of Celie, the simplicity of the language, and the prevailing belief in humanity. And like you said about the Christmas Carol, the idea of transformation, of growth, of change, and particularly for finding voice. And I didn't know when I first read Alice Walker that she was a huge fan of Zora Neale Hurston and responsible for getting a headstone for Zora Neale Hurston's burial place. And so I just was automatically drawn to these two women's work without even knowing. Like, that's how much in conversation I think they were. And my favorite is the discussion that Celie has with Suge about God, about the white male patriarchal God, which was something that I rejected at the age of 14. So imagine picking up this book by a black woman and reading, God is in nature, it's this, it's that, and how to deprogram the colonized idea around what God was. And so she says a couple of really awesome things about sin. And she says, "Suge, I say, God wrote the Bible. White folks had nothing to do with that. How come he looked just like them then?" She say, "Only bigger and a heap more hair. How come the Bible just like everything else they make and all about them doing one thing or another and all the color folks doing is getting cursed? I never thought about that." Nettie say, "Somewhere in the Bible, it just say Jesus' hair was like lamb's wool, I see." I say, "Well," say Suge, "if he came to any of these churches we talking about, he'd have to have that hair conked before anybody would pay him any attention."
So you talked about transformation, and it does seem like a lot of these books, I mean, that's at the heart of any story is some kind of transformation. But maybe what we're going to literature for when we're looking to be grounded in some kind of turbulent time, we are looking to see an example of someone changing something or transforming even themselves.
Or the power of forgiveness, which I think is probably one of the most difficult human traits to have. It's a practice. You can think you've forgiven something or someone or something, and then you realize it's waves of it. You know, you have heights of it. And I think that's what I find in all these books, particularly forgiveness of the self.
Yeah.
Natasha has just recommended The Color Purple by Alice Walker. And Jeffrey and Gowdy, along the lines of forgiveness, there is a book you're recommending that would probably be on a lot of high school syllabi, The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Yeah, I was going to ditch that, but actually I'll pick it up. The Scarlet Letter, I think, qualifies as a classic because one of our indices is it taught and is it read in the classroom? And I read it 100 years ago in high school and wrote a paper on the color red in The Scarlet Letter, 500 words. We had, it's days before computers, we had to count all the words. So I inflicted it on my students when I taught at Oskaloosa High School, and they hated me for it. But I think it's a wonderful book. Nathaniel Hawthorne was born in 1804, but he set the story of The Scarlet Letter 200 years earlier in the time of the very stern early Puritans. And it's a classic story of an outsider. It's a story of someone being ostracized, of the threat of female sexuality. Hester Prynne is made to wear an A sewn into her dress, and it's a very timely story.
The A standing for adulteress.
Standing for adulteress. She had a baby out of wedlock, as we used to say, her baby Pearl. She is the strong character in the book, much stronger than her haunted husband, Roger Chillingworth, and even her wasting away lover, the eloquent minister, Arthur Dimmesdale. And she's true to herself in the end. She does not reveal the identity of the baby's father. Arthur Dimmesdale, meanwhile, is wasting away and finally publicly confesses and then drops dead on the spot. It's a classic story of an outsider and ostracism, and also the way I think that people in their fear create an other that's a sop for their anxiety. And it's a very timely thing that's happening today. People are being branded as other and ostracized and worse.
So that is The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne, and you're seeing a lot of resonance in it.
I am indeed.
Mark Luce, what do you want to talk about?
Actually, I think I'll talk about the first story. The first story is Gilgamesh. It's the first writing we have. It dates from 2500 or so BCE, and it the translation that I do is this one by a fellow named Stephen Mitchell, who takes it. And when I first read it, I read it as a novel. It was in prose, and he has transformed it into a long poem. To me, to great effect. In thinking of forgiveness, Gilgamesh is like a jerk king. He's mean to his soldiers. He sleeps with brides the day before they get married. Like he's all about himself. He's got golden chariots. He's got singing girls, and you know he thinks he's all of that. And eventually that catches up with him, and he has to journey long and far to try to figure out how to deal with this grief that he has for causing the death of his friend. And what he really has to come to realize is that he needs to forgive himself, and he needs to appreciate the things that he has. As Shaduri, the tavern keeper, tells him, until the end comes, enjoy your life, spending in happiness, not despair. Savor your food, make each of your days a delight. Bathe and anoint yourself, wear bright clothes that are sparkling clean. Let music and dancing fill your house. And so that comes from the first story. Like, that's a pretty good lesson. That's a pretty good lesson to have.
Tell me more about the significance of this being, as you put it, the first story.
Well, it was, it's the first recorded story. Like, it's the first one that's on, it was on tablets that they discovered in the 1850s, and then they had to translate it, but it dates from 2500 BCE, like first written story. I'm sure there were stories before. I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear, but it's the first written story. And
could you illuminate for our listeners BCE?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, before Common Era. It took me a long time to It used to be just BC, right?
Exactly.
Now it's before Common Era. So basically Sumerian. So Mesopotamia, sort of modern day Iraq.
Right. So
it's pretty awesome. And he's a jerk, but he learns sort of slowly and definitely the hard way, to be kind. And I think that's another thing that literature can really help teach us is be kind to one another.
All right. Well, so Mark Luce has just recommended Gilgamesh. And I want to get back briefly to some of our staff recommendations for great personal classics. Dan Margulies, I don't think, could pick just one, but he told me what he had just finished reading, which was Jane Eyre. He said he was supposed to read it in 10th or 11th grade, but never did. He says, I was bowled over by Charlotte Bronte's astute psychological insights and amazing descriptive powers. Some readers, I'm sure, will probably find the novel a bit rococo for their tastes, but I found it to be a totally immersive experience. It lifted me out of our broken world and transported me into another broken but redeemable one. Do you think that that's part of the appeal of a great work of literature, is that maybe it's easier to cope with the brokenness of someone else's reality and then to find solutions in that before you come back to your own life?
It's kind of like doing other people's laundry, you know? It's so much easier to help a friend fold clothes than to do your own. And I think that's something as a writer that writers probably do, is that they are highly sensitive people and they look into the world and they write a story that wins.
All right. Well, we have just a little while left for this conversation. If you want to recommend what you consider to be one of the all-time great books on your own shelf, the book you'd make required reading for all of humanity if you could, call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today the bibliophiles are in session. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Katie Stover, Mark Luce, Jeffrey Angoudi, and Natasha Ria Elskari. They're recommending the books that resonate for them in a timeless way, connecting them to wisdom or humanity whenever they need it most. Personal classics, if you will. We've gotten some great recommendations so far, and I want to chime in with what people on Twitter are recommending using @KCURCST. We've got What Comes Next and How to Like It by Abigail Thomas, recommended by one listener. And someone else is actually a local author named Bryn Greenwood, who was interviewed on the show, is recommending The Way We Live Now by Anthony Trollope. We've also got another Twitter recommendation. It's The Count of Monte Cristo. Does anyone have, any of our panelists have anything to say about these selections?
Fun.
Yeah, great. These are wonderful.
Okay.
Count of Monte Cristo is an enormous book.
That is an enormous
book. I actually haven't read it, but it certainly shows up on a lot of lists of classics.
It shows up on lists of classics that men will read again. They love the adventure aspect of that book.
Men specifically?
You know, to be honest, I have not had one woman in my life say, oh yeah, I'm dying to reread The Count of Monte Cristo.
Interesting.
Stop cackling, Mark.
Well, there's also, we also have another, we had a caller who wasn't able to stay on the line, but recommended Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut. Do you consider Kurt Vonnegut to be a writer of recent classics?
You know, I was reading an essay by Laura Miller in Salon. Does she write for Salon
or
Slate?
She's moved to Slate.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, she was talking about this idea of what is a classic and, you know, what do you consider a classic? And she said that Vonnegut is migrating out of fiction into classics.
Oh, yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It's still one of those, though, that you find, you know, we put on every couple of years I'll put on either Slaughterhouse-Five or Cat's Cradle on the reading list for sophomores, or my colleague Jared will do it for juniors. And the kids still respond. I mean, one of the things about a classic is it kind of has to be timeless. Whereas like Vonnegut, I think, would be kind of falling into the classic mode. And I would tend to think, honestly, that Salinger is kind of falling out of the mode, where kids today, they read about Holden and they're like, dude, whatever.
Holden Caulfield, who's calling everyone a phony.
Yeah.
They think whatever about that? That's interesting. 'Cause it
increasingly.
Does seem, like a timeless aspect of being a teenager.
Rebellion changes.
I read that when I was 25 and thought, whatever.
Oh.
You know, I read it as a junior in high school and I thought, oh my God, the world is revealed. I don't think I feel that way now. But, you know, phony.
Well, let's talk to Greg in Overland Park to see what he's recommending. Hi, Greg.
Hello there. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. What's your personal classic?
Absolutely. One of my personal classics is Michel de Montaigne's Essays. He was a Frenchman back in the Middle Ages and the originator of the personal essay. And kind of a big difference between him and a lot of classical literature is that he's very personal and he's very engaging even to a modern ear. I almost like to think of him as the first blogger. He talks about himself, his weaknesses, his foibles, and he just kind of looks at himself very very artfully and comes across very charming and very very useful even to today's ears.
So Essays by Michel de Montaigne. Thank you so much, Greg.
Yes. Uh-huh. Thank you so much. Hi.
Interestingly, we usually think of classics, I think, people jump to fiction, novels in particular, but we've already heard, you know, a scathing social critique shared by Katie as a classic. We've heard now a collection of essays. Mark, I know you've got some plays on your list, and so we'll talk about those. But Natasha, I'm fascinated that you are a poet and so far have not mentioned any poetry collections.
I have three here.
Okay.
I have three collections. One is Head Off and Split by Nikki Finney, which was written in 2011, the winner of a National Book Award. The speech she gave at the Book Award was pushed all through social media as definitely one of the most powerful political artistic speeches in a long time. And this book is about many things, but what I love about it is the sensuality that she writes about being a lesbian, her critique of the nation's response to Hurricane Katrina, and also her roots as well. And she is a very intense personality. When she looks at you, it's like she gets inside of you, and that's what her poems are also like. So she always ties the political with the sensual, and I am a fan of that. I love this collection. I love that it ranges and that it's so powerful. And so it's called Head Off and Split. And I'll read a touch from it. This is called The Areola. I stop my hand midair. If I touch her there, everything about me will be true. The new world discovered without pick or axe. I will be what Brenda Jones was stoned for in 1969. I saw it as a girl, but didn't know I was taking in myself. My hand remembers treading the watery room just behind the rose-veiled eyes of memory. And so she goes on further just to talk about how women's body parts are miscalculated, much like the map of Africa in the world. I mean, just all these amazing social critiques. And so I am always going, all of my books are by Black women because I feel like, well, we know that Black women make up less than 1% of all published writing in any genre. And so any chance that I have to, as a writer myself, to put on and to share with people about the works of African-American women, I am going to do that because the writing is beautiful. So
thank you, Natasha.
Thank you.
Mark, you brought in some plays, as I mentioned. So
I did.
While we're making our tour of personal classics, I don't want to leave those out.
The person that I really like is August Wilson, and he died a few years ago, but he accomplished something that I think is sort of, I'm sure someone will correct me, but it's fairly unprecedented in contemporary drama. He, over a period of decades, wrote what's called the Pittsburgh Cycle, and it was a series of 10 plays, and each play is in a set in a different decade of the 20th century, and they all revolve around the Hill District in Pittsburgh. And really what they trace is both struggles and triumphs of African Americans in the 20th century. And, you know, the way that the characters are incredibly flawed. They're at times they're angry, at times they're violent, at times they're thrilled. And I think throughout there's 10 plays, and he didn't write them necessarily in order. You can choose to read them in order if you want, which is kind of like, that's the way I kind of wanted to do it. But in particular, I think Gem of the Ocean, the first one, and one that doesn't really get a lot of attention, Jitney, which was, it's set in the 70s in a gypsy cab company, that those two in particular, along with Fences, which is in the 40s and deals with sort of fathers and sons, are all really good.
What is it that takes these out of the particular thing that they're addressing on some level and raises them to this level of, like, I feel my most human when I'm reading this?
I think it's because the characters are because they're flawed. You know, I think too often we want our heroes to be, you know, perfect and, or, you know, noble in some way. And in fact, that to me, the sort of true nobility is being able to sort of recognize one's own foibles and take honest steps to try to correct them, knowing full well that you're not going to. Right. And so I think Troy, the father in Fences, is a great example of that. I mean, this is not a guy I would want to be my dad, you know. But he's a good character, and he does learn something. Whether it sticks with him is another question.
So this is The Pittsburgh Cycle by August Wilson.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mark.
Oh, no problem.
I want to turn to one of our callers, Christine in Independence. Hi, Christine.
Hi there. Well, I'd like to recommend The Little Bookshop in Paris. It's a fairly new book, but it's the story of a man in Paris who has shut himself up off from all contact with people because he's lost the person he loves. But when he goes to his little bookshop, which is on a barge in the Seine, he can look at a customer and pick the right book for their situation to help them through their grief or their anger or whatever it is, until he finally has to break his own heart open and redeem himself. And I just think it's a great book about overcoming, and it's a great book that tells you that books are helpful, whether they're fiction or not.
Well, thank you, Christine. Christine is recommending The Little Bookshop in Paris.
So the bookshop's on a boat?
It sounded like on a barge. Katie, it sounded like you had perhaps read
that. That's cool.
This one just made my short list of books to add to my book group bag collection. And I was looking at it yesterday and thinking, oh, that's charming. I know 10 book groups that will like this. And I can't remember if the bookshop's on a barge or not.
So before we go, Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, you are recommending something by Louise Erdrich.
Yeah, Louise Erdrich. And I run in two books by her, but since we don't have time, I'll bring her, talk about her most recent one, La Rose. It was just published in May, and I reviewed it for the Kansas City Star. And we've talked a lot here about forgiveness. The listener who just called talked about breaking your heart open, or emailed. In any case, that is what this book is about. It's set in 1999. It's the end of the world. It's the millennium. The end of the world obviously doesn't come, but something equally horrible happens. The five-year-old son of Peter Ravitch is accidentally shot in a hunting accident by his best friend. And so in an old form of tribal justice, Landru, the shooter, is in great anguish and brings his young son, who is Dusty's best friend, to the family and says, our son is now your son. So the Landru and Emmeline, the shooter, and his wife are native, and Peter and Nola are not native. So the boy, who's very soulful, ends up being a bridge between the families and also a bridge between cultures. I'm not sure there is forgiveness. I mean, something like that is hard to forget, but there is a bridging and an understanding and a going forward. This book is achingly beautiful, And now that it's too late for anybody to argue with me, I would say Louise Erdrich is the best novelist writing in the United States today.
Oh, come on.
And it sounds like, I mean, just to get at the things we've been talking about today, it also sounds very hopeful.
It is all about healing and that you can heal and still contain rage.
Our time is up for this book recommending session. I've loved it, and I can't wait to start reading some of the books that I haven't yet. Thanks so much to our bibliophiles, Katie Stover of the Kansas City Public Library, freelance writer and book critic Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Mark Luce from the Barstow School, and Natasha Ria Elskari, a local poet. I appreciate it, you guys.
Thank you so much.
Been a delight.
You can listen back to this show online at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, some creepy photographs of the abandoned Metro North Mall have been making the rounds online. What is it about these images that's captivated us? And what do the apocalyptic scenes say about the current state of our city and suburbs? Tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Aaron Pelish and Raven Brooks are our interns. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date's next.